Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street.
That was it. I said, Dr. King, just as he straightened up, I said, Dr. King, and the bullet exploded in his face.
I was very shocked when I heard the news that Martin Luther King had been wounded, and then when he died.
It's going to make it bad for the racial problems all over the United States now.
And it makes me wonder just what kind of a world we are living in and what's going to happen now.
Martin Luther King tried to help the Negroes and the white from not having a violence or any kind of eruptions. I think that they shouldn't assassinate him.
I pray that his family can find comfort in the memory of all he tried to do for the land he loved so well.
We were always willing to share Martin Luther King with the world because he was a symbol of the finest man is capable of being. Yet to us, he was a father and a husband.
This is The Takeaway. Today, we mark 50 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. King was in Memphis to support the city's striking sanitation workers. They were protesting abusive working conditions and low wages. The night before he was killed, King spoke at the Mason Temple in Memphis, delivering what would become known as the Mountaintop Speech.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
In a sense, Dr. King foreshadowed what was to come. The following night, April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed as he stood on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. Today, the Lorraine Motel stands as it did back in 1968. It's no longer a functioning motel. It's part of the National Civil Rights Museum. Dr. King, well, he's grown larger than life. He's an icon of the civil rights movement and a symbol for many. But for Charles McKinney, who's an associate professor of history at Rhodes College in Memphis, there's a danger in the way King's image is enshrined into our national consciousness. Professor McKinney warns us that danger should not be ignored.
We've worked hard to produce a version of King that is like a black Santa Claus, right? To decenter King, to move him away from the political ideologue, to move him away from the person who was comfortable with mass-based protest. And that's a problem because that's not the real King, right? That's not the historical King, the King who came to Memphis in defense of sanitation workers who were fighting for their lives, engaged in this radical affirmation of their own humanity, fighting for a living wage, the King who wanted to restructure the fabric of American life, the King who believed that the three evils of American society, racism, militarism, and poverty, needed to be confronted, primarily and chiefly be confronted by the federal government, right? So we're celebrating this cotton candy version of King, right? That says—
That's a loaded word, a cotton candy version of King.
Right. I mean, you know, January 15th, it's a day of service right now. So I don't, you know, and all due respect to people who go out and do service work. But, you know, if Martin King were alive now, you know, he wouldn't be telling the nation that they need to go paint houses, right? He wouldn't be telling the nation that they need to go engage in this one day of service. This was somebody who was directly and intimately involved in trying to put together a mass-based movement to restructure American society. He was in the process of putting together the Poor People's Campaign to bring tens of thousands of poor people of all colors from all across the country to Washington, D.C. to confront the reality of poverty in American life, right? So we've got to look really hard to go to find the places and spaces where that King is celebrated as opposed to the sort of toothless candy cotton version of King that we've grown up with now in the wake of, particularly in the wake of the King holiday.
When we talk about King as a political tool, how is he being used as a political tool? I know you're telling me that we are celebrating this, and it's a difficult phrase for me to say because of how loaded it is, but this cotton candy version of King, if we are celebrating that, then there must be a puppet master using this in some way. What is the form that this political tool is taking?
This is a bipartisan effort, right? And an ecumenical effort, right? This is an effort from a political establishment, a corporate establishment, right? This is an effort, this is a multifaceted effort to move us away from the king who would stand in opposition to so much of what's going on in American life. So, for instance, when politicians extol the virtues of King, they extol the virtues of a man who fought for particular political positions, who fought for the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so for people who think that politics is the end-all and be-all of a civil rights movement, right? And these are folks, again, across the political spectrum. When you push that narrative, then to a large extent, you can say, hey, we won. Right? We got the legislation passed. Therefore, you know, game over. Now it's up to you folks to, you know, to go out and make real the promise of American democracy. When we have corporations, so for instance, during the Super Bowl, King's voice is used to sell Dodge Ram trucks, right? In the drum major speech. Two paragraphs later in that speech, King calls out the auto industry for making big, ridiculous cars that people who can't afford to buy them in the first place spend money on. That's literally, you know, 17 lines down from the line that gets quoted in the Dodge Ram ad. So, you know, so King as corporate shill, this is a whole scale effort by forces in American life, forces in American society, right? You know, Black History Month, Fortune 500 companies celebrating the life and legacy of Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was fighting for a living wage. Do you pay your employees a living wage? Right? All the folks who are running around, who spend money every year to celebrate the life and legacy of Martin Luther King. The life and legacy of King was like, look, let's pay people a wage so they don't starve. Let's pay people wages so they don't qualify for welfare while they're working 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week or 60 hours a week, like the sanitation workers in Memphis. You know, so that's the life and legacy of King. King's legacy has been boiled down to sort of like, you know, it's the Barney purple dinosaur version of King. I love you, you love me. King was about love. No, that doesn't. Violence to King's legacy, right?
So you say does violence to King's legacy, but is there any way that someone could cogently interpret it differently? Could this mean that all Americans, even white Americans, may see themselves in the face and experience of this black man? Is that one way to interpret it or not?
Well, it's one way to interpret it, right? But I think the way in which the dominant culture, the way in which, you know, popular culture now and our political culture has interpreted King is they've whittled King's narrative down to this narrative of love, right? Now, love is crucial in King's thinking, morally, politically, philosophically. But King never, ever, ever decoupled love from power or justice. King is saying, look, if love is truly guiding our efforts, then there's no way that there should be starvation in the richest country in the world. If love is guiding our efforts, then people who are in power, right, should be standing in the name of love, should be standing and working to explicitly correct all of the ills and all of the evils we see playing out on a daily basis in our society. So we've stripped away King's relationship with power and justice, and now we just talk about King and love, right? We talk about content of character and not the color of skin, right? Folks love to quote the second half of the Dream Speech, but no one wants to talk about the first half of the Dream Speech where he says, look, you know what? Based on my reading of power, love, and justice, we're going to be out in the streets and we're not going home until we see some justice, until we see power working on behalf of the disinherited in this society.
If you could tell us, based on all of your research, why you believe that King was assassinated, was it just because of love or were there deeper issues at play?
I tell my students frequently that I think one of the minor miracles of the civil rights movement was the fact that Martin Luther King actually lived to see 1968. We have to remember that this was a man who was marked for death from his very first campaign in Montgomery, Alabama, to the moment he is murdered in my city, in Memphis, on April 4th of 1968. All right, so we can't decouple his assassination from a 13-year-long effort to have him murdered. racial terrorists plant a bomb under his home in Montgomery, Alabama. They didn't pull him off the side of the road. They didn't plant the bomb at his church office, right? Racial terrorists in 1955 tried to murder Martin Luther King, his wife Coretta, and their two young children, right? He's 26 years old. So he's going to spend the next 13 years living in the shadow of death. That, for me, is the point here. In terms of thinking about the assassination, we have to think about, I tend to think about the assassination as the tragic culmination of multiple efforts to see King dead, which then leads us back to having to confront the reality of violence, right? Particularly racial violence in American society. This is the most powerful advocate of nonviolence in the country, on the planet at this point. He is the face of nonviolence, not just nationally, but globally. And yet there are elements in our society that wanted to see him dead. Why? Because he's beginning to slowly understand that in order for us to move forward on these issues of poverty and racism and materialism and militarism, that it's time to start building a broad mass-based coalition, right? A coalition of poor folk, people from all backgrounds, from all races, from all walks of life.
Do you think it was that coalition of poor folks that ultimately marked him for death, that took him down in Memphis?
I think you can make that argument. Yes, most definitely.
When we talk about Memphis, some people say that in many ways there is a symbolism to him dying in Memphis. He was there hoping to raise wages for these garbage workers. And even to this day, Memphis has an unusually high poverty rate for a city of its size. How has Memphis been marked by MLK's assassination there?
We've worn this since April 5th, 1968, right? Now, I've only been in Memphis for 13 years, but in that amount of time, I've grown to love this city like no other. Memphis is such an amazing and wonderful and beautiful and complicated city, just like the people in it. We grapple with this. We deal with this. And one of the downsides of King being killed in our city, right, is that it obscures this long and beautiful struggle of activism, right, engaged in by black folk from the dawn of emancipation down to now, right? And so one of the things that I think we lose when we solely focus on the fact that King is killed here is we lose sight of the fact of his presence, of why he was here, right? We lose sight of the fact that he was called here by a group of men who had simply had enough. And this was not his first time in Memphis, right? He comes to Memphis in 1959 for a political rally. He comes to Memphis in 1966 to engage in the Meredith March, the March Against Fear, which is the last major civil rights march of the civil rights era. We wear this and it blots out the sun, right? It blocks so much other information, so many other things, right? And so this is a hard thing. And so the city has grappled with this for decades. But I think the way forward is to have an honest assessment and honest accounting of the ways in which the city has changed and the ways in which it has not. Black and white income, black folks in this town still make 50% of what white folks make in this town.
Right? Hold on one second. So 50% of what white people make in Memphis is earned by people of African descent in that city today.
Yes, that number is virtually unchanged from 1968, right? We've got the highest black child poverty rate in the country. But also, have we made gains? Yes, we have made gains, right? So when we look over the course of the last 50 years, we see a dramatic expansion of the black middle class, but also we see poverty rates and African-American poverty rates virtually unchanged. Henry Louis Gates was once asked to talk about this period, this 50-year period, and he says, you know what? The easiest way to talk about this is to say it was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
Is there enough economic opportunity given the cloud of race within Memphis to allow someone to achieve your level of success today?
Memphis is going to have to be honest with itself, right, about what Memphis can do. So on the one hand, we say we want people to achieve, and we say we want to expand opportunities for African Americans. On the other hand, we tell companies and corporations that they should move to Memphis because they can pay their employees slave wages. Mm. The Chamber of Commerce used to have some language on their website before activists pointed it out that, you know, they talked about, hey, you know, move your company here. Hey, come to Memphis because, you know, we're not unionized and you can pay these, you can pay people really, really low wages.
If we could extrapolate for a minute and look at Memphis as sort of a hyper-focused example of something in America, what does it symbolize given all the controversy over apparent growing inequality in America right now? What does Memphis tell us and what should we be thinking about as we honor the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
Memphis represents reality and potential. It represents the reality of persistent racial inequality. It represents the reality of what a town, what a city, what a county can look like when the majority of the people in that space, when African Americans are systematically and routinely shut out of the halls of power. It also represents potential. There are a growing number of organizations, a growing number of activist organizations, a growing number of mainline organizations, right? Shout out to Black Lives Matter, Memphis Grassroots Organizing Coalition, Coalition of Concerned Citizens, the Fight for 15 out in Memphis, right? Shout out to so many organizations in town who are doing the work of building, engaging in this beautiful struggle. There's a growing number of people working in the school system who are starting to understand, come to an understanding of the deleterious impact of segregation on education, right? We can't get around it. We simply can't, right? So there's a growing group of people who are saying, look, let's start having some real conversations about how we move forward, right? What's the definition of insanity? You keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Well, you know what? For the last 50 years, we've engaged in a series of practices and patterns that have gotten us here. We got to try something. We got to try something different. And so there's a critical mass of folks, I think, in this town, some elected officials, some other civic leaders, a few folks in the foundation arena, where we've got to get a few more of them on board, who are starting to say, hey, you know what, some of these old patterns and practices, they're not working. It's time to start thinking about new approaches. And so we see that in Memphis. We see the reality of inequality, but we also see so much potential to confront those realities.
Professor Charles McKinney, Associate Professor of History at Rhodes College. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our guest, Charles McKinney, said Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy has become distorted over time. And listeners, we are hearing from you. How is Dr. King's life addressed in schools today?
Hi, this is Steve, an elementary school music teacher from Nyack, New York. My students have the impression that Dr. King was a powerful speaker, close friend of the president, and widely accepted moral leader. I emphasize to them that he was arrested for protesting around 20 times, vilified by the press, and threatened with physical violence regularly. I also talk to them at length about the Poor People's Campaign, emphasizing the fact that much of what Dr. King hoped to achieve, particularly economic equality for all races, has still not yet been accomplished.
My name is Peggy, and I'm calling from Englewood, New Jersey, and I am actually a middle school art teacher. The decision about who does what to celebrate it is usually left up to me. And they might have a little bit of discussion, but unfortunately, it's not taken as seriously as I would like. I am a Black woman, and it is serious and important to me, so I do make a point of trying to incorporate some project around that time. However, it's just not enough devotion put to this. And it's sad because I teach in an urban school district and our kids really should learn more.
My name is Danielle and I'm calling from Hollywood, Florida. I have a son in fourth grade and they do learn a little bit about Martin Luther King and a little bit about Rosa Parks, but they don't really go deep into it. It's incumbent upon the parents to teach the children because the school is only going to touch the surface.
Hi, my name is Kristen. I'm calling from Evanston, and I wanted to talk about what my daughter's school does for Martin Luther King Day. They do an assembly, they have the kids perform, they read passages and sing songs, and it's like the most beautiful thing to see all the children up there, and I so appreciate District 65 for making it a priority.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you listen to podcasts.